Happy day. I'm Liza, your healing mentor. I used to say, all I need in life is for my kids to be happy and healthy. The problem was they weren't happy and they weren't healthy. Both my kids had anxiety, depression, and even Lyme disease. Then one day my daughter told her therapist, what would make me happy is if my mom was happy. So I went on a journey to find my own personal happiness. When I finally became happy, my own kids accelerated in their own healing journey. Now I share my stories, my mindset, and other inspirational healers with you. Let's heal one story at a time. Happy day. Welcome to Very Happy Stories. I have such an amazing, inspirational, and powerful episode for you today. Here's the thing. So many times when we meet with doctors, they're able to offer our children support, maybe relief, but they don't really know why our child is presenting the way they are with their ADHD, autism, anxiety, OCD, etc. My guest today, different. Dr. Robert Melillo is on the podcast today, and he is one of the world's most sought after and respected experts in developmental functional neurology, brain imbalances, and the correction of most neurobehavioral disorders and learning disabilities. Dr. Melillo is also an author of 5 best-selling books, including his best-known Disconnected Kids, which was translated in 10 different languages. What I love about this episode is Dr. Melillo is able to tell us what's happening with our children, why is this happening at a foundational level, and in ways that we can understand, right? And more than that, there are things that we can do to reconnect some of these imbalances and network of disconnections. Yes, there is hope. So I can't wait for you to listen to this episode. You might need to listen to it twice because although he shares the information in a way that you can understand, it's going to come at you fast and you might want to share it with a friend. So I can't wait to dive in. Let's do it. Happy day. Welcome, Dr. Melillo, to Very Happy Stories.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so honored to have you. I think the work that you do is so inspiring and hopeful, and I cannot wait to get into this conversation and share this with my audience.
Me too. Thank you.
Why don't we start with learning a little bit more about you? How did you become a specialist in this area of childhood neurological disorders?
Well, you know, I'm a clinician, and I've always, from the time I graduated, had an interest in neurology and rehabilitation. I have a diplomate in both neurology and rehabilitation and have a number of different postgraduate degrees, neuroscience, neuropsychology. I'm finishing a PhD right now in cognitive neuroscience. But my interest was always around neurology and rehab. And you know, very early on, I got into doing research into neurology. I was teaching clinical neurology and rehabilitation nationally and internationally, and had a very active practice in New York. But then in 1995, I came home one day, and there was a woman sitting at my kitchen table with my wife, and she was crying. And my wife introduced me to her as a woman that she had just been at a fundraiser with last night. And there was a fundraiser for a group that she had started for kids with different types of disabilities, especially ADHD, like her son, who was very severe. She was frustrated because she had tried everything. Nothing worked. My wife had talked to her and told her a little bit about my background and, you know, that I knew a lot about nutrition and diet and neurology and the brain. And so she came by to speak to me. And, you know, at the time, I didn't know a lot about child development. I didn't know a lot about ADHD. And my wife just said, you know, I think you need to help this woman. And I said, I'm pretty busy right now. I'm coming in at 9 o'clock at night. You know, we have 3 little kids. And she said, I just get this feeling that you're supposed to do something with this. So, all right, I can't deny my wife. She gave me, you know, permission. And so then about 2 or 3 days later, I go into my son's first parent-teacher meeting in first grade. It was one of the first ones I think I ever had. And the teacher there said, something to me about, she thought my child had maybe attention deficit disorder, that he was very hyperactive and impulsive. He was really bright. He was really, you know, creative, but he was the only kid in the class that wouldn't sit during like story time. And so that kind of shocked me, right? I didn't expect to hear that. But, you know, part of me felt like, you know, obviously embarrassed, like, how do I not know this in my own son? I'm supposed to be an expert in these things. You know, and but then there was a part of me that said, that heard my wife saying, you're supposed to do something with this. And, you know, I believe a lot in that, you know, that things are not coincidental. So now I had not only to help this woman, Denise, but now I was interested on my own. And but the first question I had is, what is it? What is actually happening in the brain in ADHD? And I knew a lot about the brain. I didn't know exactly what that was. So I went, you know, I first took the easy route. I went to some friends of mine, like pediatricians, pediatric neurologists, psychologists, child psychologists, psychiatrists. And I said to them, what is happening in ADHD? What is going on in the brain? Because I figured if they just direct me towards that, I could figure out rehabilitation wise, could I do something about it? And all of them looked at me funny and they said, I really have no idea, what it is. And they said, you know, but there's nothing you can do about it. And I said, that's kind of funny. Like, you're telling me you don't know what it is, but you're absolutely certain that you know you can't do anything about it, right?
Right. Then how do you know?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me. So that wasn't the way I thought. So I thought, okay, I got to figure out what this is. And I just dove into the research. And basically, you know, spent 10 years of my life interacting with some of the best researchers in the world, researching what it is, and then writing a textbook called Neurobehavioral Disorders of Childhood and Evolutionary Perspective. And after 10 years, I felt like not only had I answered the question as well as anybody, not only for ADHD, but turns out for, you know, for all neurobehavioral disorders, which basically have a similar issue. But along the way, I also came up with a unique program and approach that not only helped my son and Denise's son, but went on to help many, many other people of many different ages, not just kids. And now, and then eventually created Brain Balance. And, you know, Brain Balance is, you know, we work with over 100,000 kids in the United States and over 100 centers. And, you know, now spent the rest of my life really doing the research. And even as of 2 months ago, I just published one of the most sophisticated papers ever published in a journal called Frontiers in Neurology on the neuroanatomy of ADHD. So it's still, you know, almost 30 years later, my search continues to refine it, to get it better. But really, it's more about finding the most effective ways to change it, because that's the whole point.
Absolutely. And I want to unpack all of that. So I'm seeing like two interesting areas that I want to dive into. First of all, of course, the treatment, right? And how we can go through the rehab of it all for our children and also for adults. But before that, so what is happening? Because after 30 years of research, 30 plus years, you know, you've learned what is happening. And I've always been curious from a personal standpoint. You know, my children fell into so many special needs circles, the circle of neurodiversity, the circle of psychiatric disorders, and then also in that whole immune deficient category of PANS, PANDAS, and Lyme disease. So, you know, I know this is a loaded question. Are all those three things all one big brain disorder thing? And what's happening?
Right. Yeah. So that's, again, I'm glad you go back to that, because that's really where it should start. And, you know, the funny thing is, every day, I mean, I work with in my center and speak with parents from all over the world. I mean, just before you, I've had, you know, three or four consults with people from different countries, from Ireland, from India, and most of what I work with now is especially non-speaking autism and OCD and tics, and because that kind of combines everything, right? And one of the questions I say to them is, you've seen all these specialists and been all over the place. Has anybody ever told you what's happening in your child's brain? And the answer is exactly the same. Without hesitation, they all go, no, nothing. And, you know, you look at that and say, why is that? I mean, if they had a heart problem, I had one kid who had a hole in the heart and the mother said, you know, they showed her a diagram of what it was and a model of it and everything and described it. But when it came to the autism diagnosis, they said nothing. And it's because most people have no clue what is actually happening in the brain. Even, you know, neurologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, they really cannot really speak to that. And that's important. So the first concept I came up with when I was looking into this was something called an unevenness of skills, which basically said that in regard to ADHD, that kids with ADHD weren't deficient in everything. In fact, they were actually gifted or exceptional in the areas while struggling in others, like attention. And it turned out that that wasn't just true for ADHD, but it was true for basically all neurobehavioral disorders and most mental health disorders, that they usually are seen with, you know, very, very bright or incredibly creative people and, you know, and that. So right off the bat, that kind of caught my attention. The other thing was that in the early 90s, when I really started looking at this research, all the research was pointing to a problem in something known as functional connectivity in the brain, meaning there wasn't any single injury or damage. There wasn't any pathology. There wasn't anything clear-cut wrong with the brain when you looked at it. But when you started looking at the way that networks communicated and interacted with one another, there was something going on there that they weren't connecting properly. And that some networks seemed to be over-connected and others were under-connected. And then there were many people starting to talk about how this might be associated even with looking at the functions of the hemispheres of the brain, since those are kind of like the biggest networks and how they interact with one another. Eventually, you know, I was able to find that a few papers and researchers that were focused on something called functional disconnection syndromes, which basically was that the networks weren't really connecting, and that most of the time it was networks between the two hemispheres of the brain, that there was something going on there. And then when you actually look at the symptoms, and you look at the symptoms of, you know, autism, ADHD, dyslexia, learning disabilities, schizophrenia, bipolar, if you really break down all the symptoms and everything, and many of them have digestive problems and immune problems, and, you know, you break it all down, it doesn't make sense on the surface. Why would a child, let's say, read early at 2 years of age and be hyperlexic, but then at, you know, later on in life cannot do reading comprehension at all, right? You know, why would that be? And so it turns out that with the functional disconnection, when you look at the way the right and the left brain develop and function, that when you look at that, then those symptoms start making perfect sense. All of a sudden you realize that basically all of the different disorders and all of the different symptoms are really combinations of overactivity of certain networks in certain areas on one side of the brain and underactivity of the opposite side. And then if you have a bunch of those going on at the same time, they make up different disorders. And then if you look at right brain versus left brain, which is high, which is low, then you can really speak to almost all mental health and behavioral disorders that you see.
And then as the child is growing and having all of these different stages of brain development, now this is also changing. Not only are they disconnected, so is that kind of adding to the complexity too, that they're entering these new milestones?
Absolutely. I mean, all the time we hear about regressions in kids, especially in autism, especially around 18 to 20 months. And so, you know, what is going on there and why does there seem to be these regressions? I mean, I just spoke to the mom and she swears that her son, she had two twins, a boy and a girl, and that they were developing exactly equally until 16 months. And then from 16 to 18 months, he lost any words. He lost any eye contact. He went into his own little world. And since then, he's been in that world and still doesn't speak. So, you know, what happens during then? So I believe that what happens is that during the developmental process, because all of this is developmental, even most adult, if not almost all adult mental health issues that we look at, bipolar, schizophrenia, anxiety, which is epidemic, depression, really, they all go back to childhood from a neurological perspective. There can be psychological things that go on, and there can be other reasons to be depressed, of course. But when you look at it as a real, from a neurological perspective and everything, if you're feeling any symptom of any kind, it's happening in your brain. And so, you know, and they're usually overactivity of certain networks. Like if you feel depression, you have overactivity of the network that makes you feel sad. You have underactivity of the network on the left side that makes you feel happy, right? Overactivity of sadness and guilt and shame, which is right brain emotions, along with lack of joy, that's major depressive disorder. So what you see is that as the child's developing, the right brain develops first in the womb and for the first 3 years. Both sides are developing, but the right brain is more active. And then around 3 years, it switches where the left brain now comes online and now the left brain develops. And all of the things that we just put in a paper that should be coming out any day now on the whole evolution and development of brain asymmetry going back 500 million years. We know brains 500 million years ago were asymmetric. So we know that brain asymmetry is something that's there. We know that humans have the most asymmetric brains or lateralized brains, which means our right brain is different than our left brain. And we know that that's a great advantage. And as we go up, you know, the more sophisticated the species, the more lateralized their brain is. And the way that happens is really because the right brain develops first and whatever happening around us shapes that right brain. And so we just wrote a, you know, detailed paper on this. But the point being is that anything that interferes with that development of that right early on has a chance of interfering with right brain development. And what can happen is that left brain can come online too early, especially in children that are gifted, especially those that have genius level skills, which is every kid with autism, as far as I'm concerned. And then when that happens, it leads to the left brain then dominates over the right and prevents it from developing more. So you get this slowdown on one side, you get this left brain or right brain on the other side comes in too early, and then that further holds back the other side. This leads to this developmental imbalance in the brain. And then when you go through a growth spurt, that strong side grows faster than the downside, and the disconnect becomes more. And so now they lose whatever skills they had to begin with there.
Yes. Exactly what you're explaining, I have seen some of that in my daughter, who walked before she was 10 months old, you know, talked very, very early. But then we did see some regression in mature social emotional things, right? Saw a lot of regression.
What age did you see the regression?
I would say like middle school, like through puberty, there was an emotional regression. So it was difficult, some really difficult, challenging years. And, you know, she was immune compromised too. But I think one of the things that I'm always questioning is, why are we seeing more disconnected kids? What's happening there? You're explaining, right, why what's happening in their brains with ADHD and autism, but why are we seeing so much more of this? I saw a recent number that, and I don't know what your numbers are, but I've seen that one in 44 kids now is diagnosed with autism. What's happening there?
Yeah. My whole third book is about this. I wrote a book called Autism, the Scientific Truth. I think it was 2016 when it came out. And it was the first book that talked about, you know, really that there might be ways of lowering your risk of having a child with autism, right? By understanding environmental factors. So, you know, when someone has autism, first of all, it's virtually never a genetic mutation, right? That happens very rarely. And even then, it's not really autism. It's really a genetic disorder. It's called syndromic autism. So like a kid with Fragile X or Down syndrome or tuberous sclerosis or some other unnamed genetic mutation, you know, has a mutation and they may be labeled with autism. They may have autism traits, but it's really not autism. It's actually very different in many ways. So, you know, again, when you look at autism, there is no genetic mutation. There's no damage in the brain. There's no injury in the brain. So, you know, what is actually happening in the brain? And how does it get that way? Well, it's built on what we call genetic traits. So there's an autism trait. There's a bipolar trait. There's traits that say, you know, this runs in families. And these people aren't autistic, but they look a little, they're kind of like that, right? Like I just had a mom who just told me that, you know, her daughter is on the autism spectrum. She said, I asked her, what's your husband like? And she said, well, he's brilliant. He's highly intelligent, you know, and he's really good. I think he's a lawyer and really did well in school. And, you know, but she said, but he's definitely like somewhat autistic. And then she said, and I'm an accountant. So she was also really good with numbers and really good with. So what I look at it, the autism trait is a left brain dominant trait. We're all either right brain or left brain dominant to some degree. It's like being right-handed or left-handed. One isn't better than the other. It's not a disability to be right-handed or left-handed. It is what it is, right? And so there are advantages to both the right and the left brain. But the left brain type of personality trait is very linear and very logical, you know, academic, very good in things like math and science and engineering and computer engineering. We know that anywhere in the world, you have a lot of people in the IT industry, you have a massive cluster of autism. The highest number in the world is in Silicon Valley. And this is very good research by Simon Baron Cohen out of Cambridge. He showed these things that, you know, if you look at the families of people with autism, they have a lot of engineers and physicists, mathematicians, whereas bipolar is the opposite. Bipolar, you see creative families, you know, like artists and writers and, you know, musicians run in that family, right? So that's more of a right brain dominant trait. The left brain dominant trait is ADHD, OCD, tics, Tourette's, autism, anorexia, and both of them have different aspects of anxiety. But so you have these traits. And then there are environmental factors that affect the brain development at different stages in the womb or during the birth process, and especially in the womb. And this affects primarily functional connectivity in the brain because the human brain is the most adaptable brain of any on the planet. It's the most, 85% of our genes are there to regulate our brain growth and development. And they are the most adaptable genes because they're designed to be that way because our brain needs to grow once we're outside the womb. We have to keep our brain growth relatively small inside the womb because we have, you know, these really big brains, but humans have the smallest birth canals of any primates. So we can't really grow our brain too early. So we have to wait until we're out in the environment. So our brain is very sensitive to when it's out in the environment and it knows, okay, let's grow. And so that can be a good thing or a bad thing. Our brains are very adaptable, but if we don't have the proper types of environmental influences or we're not perceiving those influences properly, we're not able to move around our world properly, then it can alter the way our brain actually develops and it can create this imbalance, and especially in boys, because boys are more susceptible in the womb. Males are more right brain dominant to begin with. And so they're more dependent on that, and they're very dependent on early movement. And so if anything interferes with any of that stuff, you know, that's why you see four to five times more boys than girls have autism. It's not that it doesn't happen, but it's obviously more susceptible.
So many people ask me today, what is the protocol for your kids now that they have recovered? And our biggest staple is Vital Plan herbs. I even use them for my treatment. It's the only thing I use to treat my Lyme, and I feel amazing. I am so grateful for Dr. Rawls and his brand because Vital Plan herbs are clean, clean, clean. Because of this, my kids never experienced herxing. Low and slow is the name of the game here, and I successfully pulled my daughter off of antibiotics through the use of Vital Plan herbs. The herbs that we are on are in today's show notes, and you can also use my promo code for 15% off. It's simply VeryHappy15. That promo code again is VeryHappy15. So when you're talking about environment, environmental factors, can you just elaborate a little bit more on what are the right type or the wrong type or right type of environmental factors that are impacting this?
Yeah, I went through about 50 of them in my book, but I believe one factor is if the mom or the dad or both have an imbalance in their brains, right? Meaning that if they have an imbalance, again, this trait, you know, we know that there's a number of things like the age of the parents matters, the health. Obviously, if you have obesity, diabetes, or hypertension, that's like a 500% increased risk of having a child with autism. If you have problems with, if you don't have enough folic acid in your body, if you're exposed to too many organophosphates, if you're exposed to too much pollution. But primarily, the biggest drivers are lifestyle. So lifestyle, meaning that stress, what you eat, you know, what you expose yourself to, you know, the chemicals in your body, the inflammation, how much inflammation you have in your body is going to have the biggest impact. And what we see is that anytime we do something that is kind of unhealthy to our body, we create what's called methyl marks on our DNA. So this goes along with what we call epigenetics. So again, we don't have genetic mutations, but we do have epigenetic factors. So, you know, we get these methyl marks, and the methyl molecules attach to our genes and basically block some of the gene from being read by the RNA transcription and translational RNA. So it's to the genes, basically it's to the RNA, it's as if that gene wasn't there. So it's not mutated or damaged, but it's covered up so it can't be read. So what happens is that the wrong protein sequence gets translated into protein. That can affect especially brain development. And again, it's not damage, but it just means that things aren't really developing the way they should. It's kind of like if you were reading a cookbook and if two pages were stuck together, and you read the book and you did exactly the recipe, but you skipped over that page because you didn't see it, and you did everything exactly right, and there's nothing broken. The recipe was actually there, but the cake that comes out or whatever you're making doesn't quite come out the way it was supposed to come out.
Disconnect.
Right, exactly. And that's what we see as being the main thing. But the good news is that almost all of those environmental factors are completely reversible.
Yes. You had talked about the brain being adaptive.
Yeah, right.
Yes. So tell us more about that. When you see a child with these disorders, how is your treatment different? What are you doing?
Well, it all starts again with first saying what is actually happening in the brain. And then our goal is how do we change that? Right? We're not just looking to manage symptoms. We're looking to change the core foundational issue. And we do it, first of all, because we, you know, do a very good exam and evaluation. We use, when possible, we use a battery of different tests to really measure functions of the brain. I've created checklists that really give a good idea of what's happening with the brain and what areas of the brain. And then we may even do what's called a QEG, which is, you know, a brain map to really identify this and really identify this imbalance in the brain itself. And then we put together a treatment program that's geared towards that. Now, in most cases, one of the things that makes my work unique and really the primary focus over, especially the last, let's say, 10 or 15 years, has been looking at, remember I said, that there's something that affects brain development, right?
Yes.
But what is that, right? So the first thing we need to do is we need to identify what is actually holding back the brain. What holds back that right brain so the left brain comes in too early or vice versa? And what I've been able to find is that there's something called retained primitive reflexes. So primitive reflexes are reflexes that we're all born with.
Yep.
We've known about them in traditional medicine and pediatric neurology for over 100 years, and they're still part of a traditional pediatric neurology exam. And they're there basically because, as I said, when we're first born, human babies are the most vulnerable babies there are. We are completely dependent on our parents and on people taking care of us. And so, you know, we really have no control of our own movement at that point. Everything is just kind of random. And so we have to be able to actually move to stimulate our brain to start to grow. And our brain grows from the bottom up, meaning it starts from the brainstem and it works its way up like building a building. And it goes through these stages as we're developing. And what initiates that is this movement. But how do we move when we can't really control our movements? And so we're born with these reflexes that come from our brainstem that allow us to do things like rooting and sucking and grasping and, you know, asymmetric and symmetric tonic neck reflexes that, you know, in the beginning actually help the child birth themselves. So like they turn their head and it causes them to twist their body and get through the canal and they push side to side. And then when they come out, they're able to eventually, you know, roll over and then crawl on their belly and then on all fours. And then they're, you know, and then they eventually walk. And then at 1 year, these reflexes should go away and allow the brain to basically be upgraded. And now more sophisticated movement that is more under our own voluntary control can take over. And the traditional thought, even today in pediatrics and pediatric neurology, is that, you know, at 1 year, those reflexes all immediately magically go away on time, all the time in every child, and that they're not there anymore. And so pediatricians and pediatric neurologists, they never look beyond year one to see if those reflexes are there.
Wow.
And even now I've gotten, you know, a lot of criticism from traditional pediatrics, which say, primitive reflexes always go away at year one. So the fact that they're retained is a myth and that doesn't happen, right? Now, we know that anything in development, nothing's going to happen 100% on time, exactly as it's supposed to, right? It's like ignoring this. It's like saying that we know that crawling isn't a milestone anymore, right? Which our CDC just recently did, which is ridiculous.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So the idea that, you know, people have been saying and have known for a long time that there are things called retained primitive reflexes, which means there are reflexes that don't go away at one, and that we tend to see them at much higher rates in patients of kids with developmental issues. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of money for research. There hasn't been a lot of great research into that, even though it's been pretty well documented. So, you know, for me, about 10 years ago, I really started diving into doing the research on this to really prove this. And now, you know, my PhD program is all about primitive reflexes and their relationship to autism, but also something unique about primitive reflexes. What virtually nobody else ever looked at was one, you know, not only that these primitive reflexes are retained in kids, but that they can be retained full-blown in adults and even in very highly functioning adults. And so, you know, no one had really looked at that, like, okay, these reflexes, and that showed me that if they don't go away at one, they may never go away unless you do something about it. The other thing is that I also often see, and other people have noticed, that many of these retained reflexes are asymmetric, meaning they're more on one side of the body than the other. Now, they should never be. Even when they're supposed to be there in the first year, they should never be asymmetric, right? They should be equal on both sides. So when they're not equal on both sides, what does that mean? And so what does it mean actually when the reflexes are retained? Why are they retained? What is the impact of them being retained? What if they're retained asymmetrically? What does that mean, right?
Right.
This has been the focus of my research. And over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been doing a randomized controlled double-blind study with a group of neurologists and neuropsychologists. And our data is just about to be collected. Matter of fact, I was supposed to be in Cuba this week. We were collecting our data in Cuba. which has some of the best neurology department in the world, actually. But they all end up with COVID, so we have to go down in the beginning of the new year. But anyway, my research is just about to be completed. We already published three papers in the last 3 months. And then once the data is all collected, it'll come out. Then over the next year, we'll probably publish another 5 or 6 or 7 papers on the data that we've collected. And essentially, it's proving everything that I've said and everything that I ever thought as being true, that these primitive reflexes, when they're retained, it represents that there is maturational delay in the brain, right? The brain, those reflexes should go away at one. They don't go away at one. It means the brain hasn't really matured to the age of one. Does that make sense?
Makes right? perfect sense. Mm-hmm.
And then if they stay persistent, those reflexes are you know, always holding it back. But then that the asymmetry means that there's an asymmetry to maturation, meaning that one side is maturing, you know, more than the other. And that normally happens, but if it gets too out of balance, then what we see is then the other side actually further inhibits the underdeveloped side. And then this makes sure that those reflexes don't go away on their own, and that it starts the imbalance. And then that every time they go through a growth spurt, that imbalance can get worse. And what we see is these unusually gifted skills on one side, like genius level skills, and we see really, really delayed skills. To the degree that that imbalance is there and the different networks that are involved is to the degree of the severity. So essentially, you know, ADHD and autism are the same basic problem. The difference is autism involves more different networks and more severe, and there's more severe imbalance.
Got it.
Right. But basically the same features that you see in autism to one degree, you see in ADHD, you see in OCD, you see in tics and Tourette's and schizophrenia as well.
Gotcha. So that would then be like your core foundation. You're examining, right, what that is. When you find an imbalance, then what? Then you're able to remedy this reflex situation?
Yeah. So there's three things we need to do. One is we need to, as I said, identify and address whatever's holding the brain back. We have to remove the blockage. And so we have different ways of addressing the primitive reflexes to inhibit or integrate them so that they go away. That removes the blockage. Then what we need to do is we need to restore the balance there. And we need to do that by specifically stimulating primarily one side of the brain and specific networks and areas with a different combination of sensory type stimulation, physical exercises, cognitive-based activities, all different types of things directed towards the specific areas that are underdeveloped. Sometimes if the left brain is so dominant, we have to do things to actually inhibit that a little bit. We have to bring it down.
Right, because it's overbearing the other side.
Exactly, especially when there are a lot of tics and stims and all day the child is stimming and just feeding that left brain. If we don't take that down a little bit, we may not be able to get the right brain up.
Wow. Okay, quick question. Just because from my own personal experience, we had this whole brain inflammation play and we had this immune system play. Now I could see if the core foundation is disconnected, this is not just affecting your brain, but your whole entire body, right? So how do you deal with these types of things? With the inflammation or your immune system is compromised, would that change your treatment?
It may, but it really is dependent, again, on what side of the brain you're looking at. So the idea is, you know, when you look at this, I always start with why, right? Like, why does a child with autism or with ADHD or with dyslexia, why do they have more, you know, autoimmune issues? Why are they more prone? Why do they have inflammation? Where does inflammation come from? What causes the inflammation or what drives the inflammation? Why do they have a leaky gut? Why do they have food sensitivities? Why do they have those things? Why do they develop PANS and PANDAS and autoimmunity to, you know, strep throat or something that other people won't, right? So again, it goes back to the brain. The brain is the regulator of the immune system, of the digestive system. The brain controls it all. And it starts in the brainstem. And the autonomic nervous system comes from the same area of the brainstem that these reflexes are. And when they go away, it means that that area of the brainstem matures. What we know is that all children are born with a very high sympathetic tone, right? The fight or flight system, which really is also more of an inflammatory system. It drives kind of inflammation. And so what we see is that, you know, children are born with that fight or flight system in place. And then around, you know, a year or so, the vagal system, the parasympathetic system should kick in and it should dampen that. And their heart rate should drop and they should be able to start digesting solid foods. They should be able to sleep through the night. And in kids with right brain delays, especially, that doesn't happen. So they're, and the reason why it doesn't happen is because that vagal system is the last thing to mature in the brainstem. And when the reflexes don't go away, that brainstem doesn't fully mature. And so they're always in this fight or flight sympathetic nervous system. When they are in that fight or flight, they also stay in a persistent leaky gut state. We're all born with leaky guts. Babies have leaky guts for a reason, because they get most of their adaptive immune system from their mom's breast milk and from her antibodies. Antibodies are large immunoglobulins that wouldn't get through a regular stomach lining. So we're born with leaky guts on purpose. And then around 1 year to 18 months, when that vagal system starts to kick in, you should have, your gut should close up and no longer be leaky. And you should produce digestive enzymes and acid and be able to break down food. And then you have increased blood flow to the gut, which then allows you to absorb all the nutrients. But in children with developmental delays and persistent reflexes, that doesn't happen like that. So what happens is they have a leaky gut their whole life. And with a leaky gut means that they're not breaking down foods. They're not digesting, you know, large proteins like gluten and casein. And the other thing is that the two hemispheres regulate the immune response. The left hemisphere activates the immune response. So it calls on the white blood cells and the antibodies and the cytokines and the inflammation, which is meant to fight things off. The right brain suppresses that. Once the fight is over, the right brain says, okay, we don't need to be inflamed anymore. We don't need to be fighting these things anymore. Or the other thing is the right brain allows the immune system to recognize ourself from other. So we recognize this is my body, don't attack it, and this is something else. What we see is, you know, many kids with autism develop things like eczema or asthma, food sensitivities, and then can actually develop autoimmune issues like eczema, where their own immune system starts attacking their own skin cells because it can't interpret which is me and which isn't me. And that leads to this process of inflammation, which will affect the whole body and the whole brain, but it was driven by the imbalance in the brain. So therefore, you know, helping the gut is important. Trying to close it up is good, but you're not going to do that unless you get that brainstem and that balance between that parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system to work. But ultimately, you know, when you're doing all these different nutritional things, they're good and they're helpful, but you're just kind of managing symptoms and putting out fires. You're not dealing with the core issue.
Yes.
And so the core issue goes back to that.
Makes perfect sense. I always believed that I knew what I was talking about when I kept telling people, no, this is all one thing. This is all related. Please. But you just explained all the pieces of why it's all related. And it all goes back to brain imbalance and the disconnection between the two sides and the two sides not working properly, right?
Yes.
So through your work and the treatment and the protocols that, you know, that you provide, can you balance out the brain for children and adults? Is there a window of time where it closes Can people expect that like their children could stop dropping medications? Tell me about the realistic expectations.
Yeah, the realistic expectations is in most kids that are pretty high functioning, we can completely correct those issues. And again, you know, one of the things that you said was that the brain is dysfunctioning, and that's true. But remember, I always come from, and this is absolutely true, and I have the research to prove it. The people that end up with these imbalances, the children that end up with these imbalances, it starts off with the fact that they're unusually gifted in one area of their brain, right? And that's important because, you know, I just had this mom who, again, was from Ireland, and she was telling me that, you know, her son does all of these pretty brilliant things. But, you know, the UK is terrible right now. I mean, they give no services whatsoever. And they basically, you know, she said to them, like, he had developed this terrible eczema on his skin. And they brought him to a doctor there. And the doctor said, well, that's autism. That was his answer. It's autism causing the eczema. Like, okay, how? And what are you going to do about it? And what does that mean? Right. So basically, they were like, well, just there's nothing you can do. Just accept it. Just leave it that way. And, you know, had no idea. And so that's really what kind of frustrates me about a lot of this is that you can really help it. So what I've been really focused on, you know, I created centers all over the country that dealt with really high functioning kids, and they work great. And they're still, you know, great option. But I wanted to work with the kids that I didn't design that program with for, which were the non-speaking autistic kids, genetic disorders, brain injury, you know, adults with, you know, severe mental health issues. And I knew it was the same problem, but I knew it would take a slightly different or very different solution. So that's where the Melillo method comes from. The Melillo method has been, you know, the last really 5-7 years really focusing on, you know, around the world and working with the most challenging cases I can get my hands on and really diving into the research even more and trying to come up with a reproducible program that we could work with anybody and get reproducibly great results. And that's what we do. And I would say that we, you know, in every kid we work with, every adult we work with, we get tremendous changes. Now, are there some kids that, you know, and I would say that the majority of the kids we get to start speaking within 6 to 9 months of some level and more or more functional speaking. And in many of the kids that are really, we get young kids that are nonverbal. We have had many kids that were completely verbal and completely neurotypical by the end of year one. And the important thing to know is we're not changing this child. We're not changing who they are as a person. If anything, we're bringing it out more. Because this child is a brilliant child, but yet because of this imbalance, they can't tap into that. I had this mom, I was lecturing in Dallas a couple of weeks ago, and a mom came to see me there. And I was like, why are you here? And she said, I just needed to speak with you in person and tell you about what you did with my son. And she said, I went through your treatment and your program and you know, he was completely nonverbal. And now he's completely verbal in a mainstream school. He's a great kid. And we realize now that he's a math genius, that he'd be in the back of the car and he'll say, hey, mom, what's 88 times 91? And she's like, I don't know. And he'll just go, boom. And then she goes to her phone and she checks it. And every single time he's right. Right now, that kid has always been a genius, but they're just realizing it now at like 7 years old.
Wow. Right?
And so I don't know if that would have ever come out. So that's where I get, you know, people talking about acceptance. Believe me, I understand that. And I devoted my life to working with kids to try to help them and to try to make people understand them and let them know it's not their fault. And, you know, it's the brain. But there's a thing also where, you know, acceptance is also kind of saying that you can't change anything. And, you know, if somebody individually, a parent or an individual person says, listen, I'm fine the way I am, leave me alone, I don't want to change, that's great.
Right.
But if somebody else, another parent says, no, I want to see if I can help my child, or, you know, what the people that will say that are people that can speak usually. So like, oh, all right, you're speaking. What about the people that can't speak? What about their voice? So, you know, what we can say is that, you know, we get incredible results in all age groups. And there are some kids that are will most likely never speak. And that's one thing, but there's ways of improving their ways of communicating, giving them better nonverbal communication, better ways of communicating, whether it's through a, you know, a device of some sort or whatever. But, you know, the main goal is to try to get these kids so that they can get educated. They can get a real education. I put my program now in a school for autism here on Long Island. So there's a guy who owns 10 schools for Long Island, and he and I are similar in wanting to really make a difference. And so we're doing a pilot study right now in a school up here. And it's about 3 months in, and the results so far are fantastic. Because again, they even admitted to me, they said, we're really kind of doing glorified babysitting. You know, we're not really addressing the problem because we don't really know what the problem is.
Right.
And so that's where all that other stuff is good. Everything else, ABA and OT and PT and all of that is very important. But the point is you have to direct it towards a specific problem.
Yes, exactly. So how do people work through the Melillo method? Can you go to somebody local that's trained? Do they have to come to you in New York? Is this telemedicine? How can parents get this for their children?
Well, you know, we do virtual and in person. Obviously, especially with the most complex cases, I really want to see them myself, right? I mean, I'm here. I'm examining every patient. I have a great staff with me. But when it comes to really figuring out what's going on, I don't really figure, you know, I trust myself. But I do have great doctors and therapists around the world that are trained in my method, that have been certified in my method, that have gone through a very stringent course with me. And so there are people around the world that are certified. The only problem is I've been building it up so rapidly as of now and changing it and morphing it and perfecting it that all COVID, I really refined this. I use COVID to really refine this. So a lot of the people that I've trained before, I haven't been able to give them a lot of the updated information because they haven't been able to come to any of my courses. We do it virtually, and my books are also meant as an instruction manual. So, you know, they can use part of my book, but the Melillo method is very different in many ways. We use much more advanced tools. You know, it's all in our center. It's all, you know, licensed therapists and doctors. And, you know, we use all different types of really cutting edge tools like transcranial direct current, alternating current, neurofeedback, TEN stimulation. We have these really, we've designed these video games and virtual reality that stimulate specific networks on one side of the brain or the other. We use different frequencies of vibration, frequencies of light and color and smell and sound and music and all different types of movement type therapies that we do. And all directed in combination towards, you know, building up one side and maybe, you know, inhibiting the other a little bit. So virtually we do, I do virtual programs with people all over the world all the time. I do have a really great home program for people. We have videos, we have instructions, you know, I meet with them virtually periodically and go through everything with them. I still, you know, if there's somebody on the ground near them that I've trained, then I'd love for them to see them. In an ideal world, you know, they come see me, they stay here with us. You know, people every day, we get people from all over the world. I mean, every Monday we have 8 to 10 families that are flying in from all over the world or all over the country.
And they're there for a week? How long are people there?
A week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 months, 3 months sometimes. With family from UAE that's going to be here for 3 months. We just had a family from New Zealand that was here for 3 weeks. We have a guy from Australia that was just here for 3 weeks. He's more of a 42-year-old guy with kind of bipolar depression. And what we're doing with them is we're not only working with them and identifying and put together the best program, but we're training them on my method. We're either training the parents on how to take this back home, or the individual had to take it back home for themselves. So it's basically like an intensive training program for the parents as well, because you know, we can't do it in just an hour or 2 hours. It really ideally, and we need to really be hand over hand and show you what's the right pressure, what's the right location to do these primitive reflex stimulations. And then they go back and then we monitor them. And then depending on if they're local, you know, if they're from New York or from, you know, somewhere relatively local, they may come in a couple of times a week. If they're, you know, from somewhere relatively local, you know, within the United States, we may see them every 3 months for a reevaluation and an update. If they're coming from really far, then it may be every 6 months. But they come back, they follow up. Usually, you know, we start out thinking in terms of 1 year. And our goal is to get that child or that that individual caught up to where they should be in that 1 year period. And most of the time we're successful. There's always, you know, some cases that are more challenging and it'll take longer than that. But, you know, that's where we're at. I'm looking at hopefully also working at, you know, trying to train other and license other facilities around the world to be able to do this, because there's such a demand right now. And I realize that no matter, you know, some people are never going to be able to travel to New York, or so we want to be able to make that available around the world. And I've kind of created the prototype and the model here in New York now that can be reproduced.
That is amazing. It's just so inspirational, because when you think about it, you have found a way to rebuild that foundation that was lacking, no matter what the age. And when you can get that core foundation right and balance everything out, I mean, that's the answer, right? That's where all the healing is. So, I mean, your work is so inspiring and amazing. And it is just such an honor to have you on and share this, truly.
Well, it's been great for me. You know, explaining this, it's hard to do it in 5 minutes, you know, so it's good when we have time. And, you know, especially with mom like you, you know, that's who I work with almost all the time. My heart is with the mothers out there that are doing this day in and day out and will fight for their children no matter what. It's just, it's so inspirational to me. You and the other mothers and parents out there are my inspiration. That's what keeps me going. That's what keeps me fighting to get this to become a standard, so that this becomes the new standard in how we look at things and how we treat children.
I love it. And I love your mission. And thank you so much for all the work that you do. We're going to make sure we have your website and everything in the show notes so people can find you and work with you. And thank you so much, Dr. Melillo.
And one other thing I did one of my bucket lists was to do a TED Talk. And I did just do a TED Talk recently that kind of goes through a lot of this. So, you know, that's something that I really appreciate anybody watching this, that when that does come out, if you view it and if you share it, because that's a really big platform to bring this out to the world. And the more people that know about it, it's one of those things like when you hear it, you go, oh my God, this makes so much sense.
Makes
right?
sense to me. If it can make sense to me, other moms are going to get it too. So you have a very gifted way of just explaining it in a way that we definitely understand.
Well, it's all in Disconnected Kids as well. So they should read that if they get a chance. You know, I have 7 best-selling books, and we're working on a 3rd edition of Disconnected Kids right now and updating it with a lot of new information. And I hope to come out with an adult book next year. So yeah, so it's all there for people to read. They go to my website. I have, you know, about 70 scientific papers that I've written that people can download. So, okay.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you felt inspired, please submit a review. More reviews help others find Very Happy Stories. And don't forget to subscribe and share this with someone else you know who could use a very happy story right about now. Until next time, have a happy day.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.